Welcome to another episode of the Rugby Buzz, a brand new podcast brought to you by H&HB Events. My name is Mark Hartery, and I'll be your host as I chat to rugby stars past and present about matches that they played in or were involved in that remain highlights for them. Today, I'm delighted to be able to chat to former Gloucester rugby star Nick Wood. Nick joined the senior Gloucester setup in 2003, having graduated through the academy. He played 278 times for Gloucester, including a record 204 premiership appearances, scoring 9 tries. He represented England under-21s and the Saxons and toured South Africa with a senior England side before illness cruelly denied him a full cap. Since his retirement in 2016, Nick now referees on the pro circuit and is head of rugby at Radley College in Oxfordshire. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the Rugby Buzz. How are you doing?
Well, for the third time, I'm doing very well. Thanks, Mark. It's good to see a friendly face and looking forward to this.
Good. Yeah, no, it's the way of the world these days with video calls. I guess in your role these days, you've been sick of the sight of video calls, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Part of it, I'm sure, is down to my posture and from far too many scrums over the years, but sitting down staring at a computer screen for hours on end does not do wonders for either my back or my neck. So,
no, I bet. No,
this term's been a welcome change to have the boys back at least. So, you know, face to face interactions, standing up and talking to people rather than staring at a screen.
Yeah, I mean, for those of the listeners that don't know, you're head of rugby at Radley College, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I was the year that I retired, I came to work here. Part-time in a rugby professional role, and the year after that, so that would be the 2017 season, still working seasons, I suppose, you know, ingrained into me after all these years, 2017-18 season, I took over as master in charge of rugby. I've been doing that since, amongst other things at the school.
And what does head of rugby entail?
Head of rugby at Radley, a school which is all boys, all boarding, just expanded to near enough full, but a capacity of 750. Wow. Involves running a program for between 400 and 450 boys, depending on depending on the year. Comfortably over 400 boys playing rugby. So a huge program. We put out 20 teams on average every weekend. Wow. So, yeah, quite a challenge, certainly in terms of ensuring that there's participation and safety, clearly top of the list, and then performance aspects of my job as well.
And with the COVID restrictions, you're not back fully at stage D yet with the restrictions, but what are you able to do with the guys at the moment?
We're still operating at stage 2, so we're still working maximum groups of 20 per half pitch, just playing various different formats of touch, working on skills. In some ways, it's been a nice opportunity. You know, we've done mixed ability teams. We had various different touch format and had turned them into competitions. And it's been nice to see boys that potentially I might not come across, but also I think a nice chance for those who have traditionally been in higher teams to showcase what they can do, and those who haven't perhaps been noticed by the various coaches over the years to show what they can do.
As you say,
one of the benefits has been to open the club up from bottom to top, which I think will be very healthy going forward.
Yeah, and at the top end with the first 15 and the other lads, is there any tie up in terms of progression with professional rugby?
Yeah. We have a number of boys in Wasps and Northampton setups at the moment across different age groups.
Okay.
Technically, we're on Gloucester's patch as part of the RFU's designation in terms of areas. And we have a few guys lower down who are involved in their DPP program, which up until recently has been running out of Radley itself. So okay. Plenty of links there for boys who wish to push on.
Okay, and the guys involved in Wasps and Northampton, is there any real difference between those setups from what you were used to at Gloucester, or are they pretty much standardised these days?
Each one will have their own idiosyncrasies, I'm sure, but Yeah, generally they're all very well run programs where the boys get an opportunity to train and compete with guys of similar ability and test themselves against the best in their age groups.
Okay, so yeah, 400 to 450 boys, that must keep you pretty busy.
Yeah, it does. No, it's an exciting, for me, it's an exciting part of the job. What's my role to the greater game? My role is not necessarily to produce X number of professionals per year. My job is to, for the health of the game, to keep as many people interested and enthused about the sport as possible. Now, whether that's, it's a bit of a cliche these days, but that makes it no less true. But whether that's, you know, in terms of as a player at the community game, whether it's as kit man, whether it's going to watch rugby and putting some money behind the bar, or whether it is the guys who are, you know, who work hard enough, who are driven enough to push on and see what happens at the next level.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's not all about the guys that go forward to the elite sport. It's about grassroots as well, and it's good to hear that that's all part of your remit as well. Now, I know
the biggest headache for me is to ensure that the right, you know, guys who are dons, which is what Radley calls a teacher, are, you know, the right dons are with the right teams.
Yeah.
Based on personalities, based on ability, we have enough to ideally put two dons per team of roughly 20 boys. Yeah. And then the second headache, I suppose, for that is, well, if we have 20 fixtures, 20 teams available for every weekend on average, 12, it'd either be 12 or 8 at home, is then finding enough referees to make sure the games can A, go ahead, and B, go ahead safely.
Yeah. And talking about referees, I know just after you retired, you've been known to do a bit of refereeing. Are you still involved with that?
Yeah, I've been working hard at it. Actually, I probably did, in terms of balance of time, I would have done a lot when I was working part time, exploring my options in that first year post retirement. I had a bit more time on my hands. But since I've been working full time at the school, and now since 2018, I've lived at the school. They've been great in terms of allowing me Saturdays, when there aren't rugby fixtures, to go out and referee. So, you know, I miss out on a significant chunk between September and mid-December. But yeah, there are Sundays, Mondays, Wednesday night games, half term. You know, there are three weekends across our half terms. There are always opportunities to pick up games. Really enjoyed sort of working my way up through the leagues, and got to the stage last year where I was about to do my first championship game, which was going to be Ealing against Yorkshire Carnegie, and then it was called because of COVID. So, and at the moment, fortunate to have been invited to help out with, or to referee some of the next league off the block, which is the Women's Premiership. So I did my first one a couple of weeks ago, Sarries against Worcester.
Brilliant.
Which was nice on a personal level, mainly because the cards were in my pocket for once at Allianz Park. and secondly, I didn't have to use any. This weekend, I'm going to be at Six Ways reffing Worcester Ladies against Wasps Ladies.
Okay. So again, that's keeping you busy. And you did some stuff as a sighting officer as well at some point. Again, is that still, as things get back to normal, hopefully, will you still be involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, that's proved. That proved at certain times, you know, in terms of citing premiership, that proves trickier when I've got to commit, you know, in terms of reffing as well. Yeah. If I'm giving up a Saturday, then going citing on a Sunday, that I'll do a few of them. But obviously, you know, I have three young kids. I'd like to see them at some point.
Yeah,
I'm still doing it, and the premiership that's restarted this year, we've been doing it remotely, so that's certainly made it easier. But I mean, the whole thing that my actual job at Radley, my hobby on the side, or my passion on the side, which is the reffing, and then the sighting as well, trying to balance, and family, obviously, trying to balance that and make sure they all work together.
Yeah. So the intention, refereeing wise, is still to try and climb as high up that ladder as you can?
Look, I'll never strive. Whilst the body holds out, I'm 37. I'll be 38 in January. Feeling in reasonably good nick, but I'm also very conscious that I played a lot of first team rugby in the front row, and I'm not a spring chicken. So, well, as long as the body holds out, I'll strive to go as far as I can, just try to get better. Well, where that takes me is not necessarily the determining factor, because that's not why I started doing it in the first place.
No.
I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy operating under pressure. I enjoy being part of the game. I enjoy going to all these clubs that I was very fortunate in the sense that, you know, I got to start in the Gloucester Academy in 2001 and stayed there until I retired in 2016. But unfortunate in some ways that I didn't get to see most of the community side of the game, most of the local club rugby that goes on, and all these fantastic places and personalities, and to share a beer and swap stories. And you know, that's actually one of the major reasons that I like going out with the whistle.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to retain part of it. So as an ex front rower, referee in the scrum must be dead easy for you, isn't it?
It's become easier with the variations that have come in, where in the women's premiership now, it's a free kick for a knock on or forward pass.
Yeah.
So I think I had 5 scrums to do in Saris versus Worcester. What would I say? I would say that it gives me a certain amount of credibility.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I get every decision right. I'm certainly able to articulate what I'm looking for, and if I've seen something, whether or not it's a 50-50 call, at least I've given a reason as to why, rather than pulling something out of the back pocket. I've never claimed to get everything right, not just around the scrum. There's so many nuances with refereeing rugby union, as I'm sure you know, that it's all about, you know, yes, his accuracy is important, but it's also about acceptability and credibility of your decisions and your relationship with the players.
Mm. Yeah. And as you say, being ex front row, that must do your credibility the world of good when, as you say, there's a 50-50 decision, but you can make a reasoned call as to why you've made the decision you have.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you'd be surprised how fast that credibility wears off, if I ever had any. You'd be surprised how quickly it wears off. I don't want to be, in some ways, I don't want to be out there and judged on the fact that I used to play. I'm out there to be judged by completely different criteria.
Mm. Yeah, which is fab, and I'm delighted that you're still able to continue the refereeing and still stay involved in the game at that level as well, which is brilliant. Your favourite game? You're taking us back just over eight years to a Bath Gloucester game. At the Rec, it was February time 2012, so you know, heart of winter. The Rec pitch is the Rec pitch. Is there any Bath Gloucester is a huge game as far as both sets of fans are concerned. Is there any particular build up to those games? Is it a game as a player you really look for on the fixture list?
It had that unique position that a lot of my good mates and other teams were actually playing in the team that supposedly as a team we hated the most.
Yeah.
Without wanting to, this is not a comment on labelling. You know, Exeter Gloucester as a West Country derby, or Bristol Gloucester as such, or Worcester Gloucester as such.
Yeah.
In those days, you know, I know the original derby was Bristol Gloucester, not Bath Gloucester, but in the period that we're talking about, it's Bath Gloucester that had come to assume this derby match. You know, if any, you know, that was the one that we thought was, of all the sort of domestic league games. You know, we knew that it was going to be tough, and obviously there was this stigma as well. I think I think we'd won in 2011 away mm-hmm. down there.
Yeah.
And that was the first time we'd won there since the Premiership had started. Yeah, even in 2006-07, that season where we finished top of the league, I think we only managed to draw away at Bath. So there was that sort of, had to break that bogey. But yeah, it was just a great place to play. The conditions, pitch was a wreck. Yeah, so what? That was part of the experience. You're playing against a big lumpy pack always, and with some properly good players as well. It was exposed. You had the crowd, obviously partisan, but screaming at you as well. It's just one of those great places to play.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the crowd because it's very intense there, and as you say, partisan. that must help us in some ways as a visiting player?
Oh, definitely. Even places like Welford Road, some atmosphere was always better than or preferable to no atmosphere. Yeah. For both teams and for the quality of the game, just, you know, and perhaps that's been something that's, you know, with the restart of the Premiership this year, it's been noticeable that crowds haven't been there. And it's no reflection on the players' efforts who are out there still putting their bodies on the line, but there does seem to be something missing.
Yeah.
Just as part of the experience, the package as a whole, not questioning the players' efforts or performance, but part of the whole, as a fan now, part of the package is that, you know, the crowd who are there, you know, and even if you're watching on TV, obviously the noise comes through and, you know, doesn't necessarily influence decisions, but, you know, reactions to certain decisions. And, you know, for me, it's been a notable lack. And those are always the great places to play. Mm. You know, 20,000 people or whatever it was at Welford Road, screaming at you every scrum, every maul. I'd always take that over, you know, playing in front of one man and his dog.
Yeah, yeah.
As Dean Ryan or Carl Hogg, one of them's appropriated it from the other one, but as one of those two used to put it.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely. And what would have been the build up to Bath to the game? You'd have travelled down there in the morning and bus and so on. I mean, tell us about what that build up was like, particularly at Bath and particularly turning up at the ground and so on. And again, lots of fans milling around as you turn up. Again, what's that like?
Yeah, trying to break this duck of winning at Bath. Every different combination of travel, hotel on the day, food, walk to the ground. You know, I don't think we quite got to the stage where we caught a boat to the ground, but I'm sure it was next on the list had we not started to notch up a couple of wins yet. That's probably the answer, really. We tried everything, thinking that, you know, in hindsight, it just seems a little bit silly that, you know, anything really that was wrong was upstairs. Or, you know, generally they were better than us at that various stages. Or on the day, I think there's always a temptation you can go looking for too much. In hindsight, it's quite funny how many different things we tried to get the build up to it right. And stretching my memory here, too many whacks to the head and all that. But 2011 was a Friday night game, and I think the 2012 game we're talking about was a Saturday afternoon.
Saturday afternoon.
I think we may have done the same thing for both. I think we may have travelled down on the day. We're unlikely to have stayed overnight for the Friday night in 2011. Mm. And the Saturday, I think we just, you know, we either went changed or got changed at the hotel because the rec changing rooms were notoriously tiny. Heating always turned up to the maximum. You know, again, all part of the experience and things that years and years on, you don't forget. But ultimately, how much of a difference did that stuff make? For me, that was always peripheral.
Yeah.
You know, I knew if I was in the right place mentally. I'm more than mad enough to admit that I probably wasn't in the right place mentally for every game that I played. That wasn't through lack of effort. It wasn't. It's just one of those things. You know, various different, as you get older, distractions and you know, various other things going on in your life. I'm not sure that, you know, what you ate or, you know, how you travelled, when you travelled, did you have, you know, 3,000 count Egyptian cotton sheets on your bed, that kind of stuff. I'm not sure. The danger too much when it comes in, you start to distract from what your actual job is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it, isn't it? It's like the fans wearing the lucky pants last time we beat Bath, I was wearing these pants. I'm going to put these on again. And it has no real resemblance to what's happening around that. But
at least in that scenario, that's an individual decision.
Yeah,
that means something to an individual. But the blanket approach thing, changing various different things for an entire group, well, it's going to have different effects on different people.
And that's
why I just don't think there's any one solution other than each person needs to concentrate on getting themselves to the place they need to be.
Yeah. And you mentioned, obviously, Gloucester had won in 2011. You'd beaten Bath at King's Home earlier that season. I think on the bounce, you'd won four on the bounce against Bath. So going into that one, did that make you favourites, do you think? Were you expected to win? I know the players would have thought so, but did you feel any pressure on that?
Look, that was also a good time. I mean, no one really talks about 2011, 2012 in terms of the quality of the Gloucester squad across those couple of years. But you know, we're still riding off the back of 2011, 2010, 11. You know, we'd recovered the kind of form almost that, you know, we weren't far off where we were in 08. Mm. You know, 07, 08, obviously, where we didn't manage to actually win anything, but had topped the league twice.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get back there with a different look squad, a different set of coaches. You know, 2011, we lose this last minute kick to Saracens away, who go up, lose 12-10, who go on to win the Premiership. Mm. You know, those little decisions that, you know, Charlie Sharples decides he's going for the ball. Different ref, different day may have given it to him, but you know, that's the such is life. So we still had that core squad involved, and actually we were still third, coming to this Bath game in 2012. So after the turn of the year in the 11-12 season, we were still sat third or fourth in the league, I think.
Mm, yeah.
What happened from then on? We didn't have a big squad. So that was the difference between the sort of squads of 07 and 08, where we could, you know, quite a few positions had a couple of internationals.
Yes.
Whereas we didn't have that in 10, 11, 11, 12. We had a very strong 25, 26 players. And once we started to lose the guys with experience through injury, I think by, you know, the end of March, I think we'd lost 10 or 11 out of our what would have been our starting 15. And that had a massive knock. So we would drop from third or fourth, I think, and end up finishing ninth, losing six or seven on the bounce. But those are the fine margins. It didn't suddenly become a poor squad. It was just we didn't have the depth yeah. to back up, you know, the kind of brutality of a Premiership season.
Yeah. And you mentioned the sides again. Looking down the team sheet at the two sides. I mean, the Gloucester side, as you say, probably first choice in terms of the backs you had out, and a pretty handy pack as well to go with it. And you know, Bath again were, you know, they picked a big old pack, you know, pretty traditional in terms of what they were offering at that particular time. So again, it was on paper, it was a game that, yeah, you were in and should have done pretty well at. But the game itself, you touched on your penchant for kind of disappearing early in some games. But again, a couple of yellow cards right at the start. I think Jim Hamilton and Ryan Caldwell had a disagreement, I think it was said, and led to a bit of an altercation. And 3 or 4 minutes in, Barnsley's brandished two yellow cards, and the derby's off to a typical start.
Yeah, my penchant for disappearing early. I'm not sure about that. Once for the red, the only red.
Yes, I know.
I'm sure everyone's well aware of that one. And the other one for an early departure for a yellow was Toulouse at home. Toulouse,
which I've just the
57 previous, seconds, I think that one was.
The previous podcast I did with Charlie, and he picked that game. He picked that game as his favourite. So yeah, we covered that off when it's out when it goes live. But
did he mention my 70-meter clearance kick?
No, he didn't actually. No, but
that didn't stick in his mind. that was again part of the reason that I wanted to pick up the whistle was any frustrations around refereeing decisions in the past, of which there were plenty, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought, well, yeah, put my money where my mouth is.
Well, absolutely. You know, and not
what
a lot.
I did was, what I did in that Toulouse game warranted a yellow card. What had gone on beforehand, how that had been completely missed by either TMO or any of the officials, was somewhat up for debate.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah.
There was a question there somewhere, wasn't there?
I think there was, yeah. The a typical start to derby. Two yellow cards, two of the lock. Jim and Caldwell go off to the sin bin. Does that? I mean, what effect does that have on the rest of the players? You know, Barnsley brandishes the two yellow cards. Does it calm it down? Does it? You know, what kind of effect does that have?
Again, go back to that point about accuracy and acceptability in terms of what the ref does in that situation. And Barnsley got it spot on. Now, what would have happened these days with TMO intervention, with rightly so, but the changes around contact to the head, actually for the time, for the context, for the match, Barnsley dealt with that brilliantly. And what it did was set the tone for, a derby match. Yeah, yes, it's going to be feisty. Yes, it's going to be full on, but that's not acceptable. You're both going off. And for the next 10 minutes, 14 players on either team got on with it. And when those two came back on, it did develop into a cracker of a game from both sides, because it's not like I picked a game that, we've absolutely hammered someone. This was a close fought encounter the whole way through, and all the more memorable for being so.
Yeah, definitely. And following that, it was actually Bath that got on top first, wasn't it? I think Tom Biggs scored. And again, looking back at the game, a grubber kick from Lee Mears for Tom Biggs to run on. And again, Bath take the lead. Probably at that point, with the run of play, would you say that they were probably just about on top at that stage? But that seemed to galvanise Gloucester and came back into it. And you're spot on. It was hammer and tong, wasn't it? Both ways. It was one side would take a bit of an ascendancy and so on, and then you get Gloucester back into it with a try out wide. That sounds good.
It does. Yeah. First, it sounds good that I scored a try, which is all too infrequent. Come on, who did the real damage there? Eliotta, for minus Apollo, does the damage. He goes absolutely screaming through the middle. Manages to get the ball away to Tins, who's then just held up short. And then the only piece of skill that I offered there was catching the ball in horrendous conditions. Sinbad throws out this 35, 40-metre right-hand pass. I mean, how has he got even enough grip on the ball to do that? Yeah. And then one of the advantages of being slightly sort of rotund and heavier in those days is that I could slide in from 10 metres and manage to take a very low trajectory to the try line.
But yeah, no.
I remember being on the back of that. And the reason I was on that wing is because we just had either a scrum or a maul, I think it might have been. Yeah. So around the halfway line. So I just had my head stuck in the mall, look up, and the play's gone 40, 50 metres down the field. And I said, well, the shortest route for me to contribute to this game was just to run straight down the touchline. Yeah. Not because it was a favourite position of mine, but actually just the way we were playing at that time, that's what made sense. Maybe I could have actually, possibly I should have given it to Matt Cox, who would have gone in untouched rather than being almost caught by Nathan Catt.
But you're spot on. It was, I think, Freddie made a break and then Elliot just burst through the centre, and as you say, recycled and you catch it and slide in. But again, that was on the back of a good Gloucester resurgence, wasn't it? So Bath had started well, Gloucester came back into it. Really started to get a grip on the game. And then I think a bit later on in the first half, you had, again, for want of a better term, a try butchered, really. I think Hugh ignored the overlap and went himself and then dropped the ball, just before half time, what effect does that have on the side itself? You should have scored, and I think Fred did.
I think at that stage, not enough to swing the game. You get a sense of whether or not you're in a game. You can go into half time winning and thinking, actually, so and so, whichever team, have got something up the sleeve here. Or you can go in confident, knowing actually scoring doesn't really matter. We're in this game. Whatever happens at the end, we're in this game.
Yeah,
that was the mentality at the time. And look, the reason I picked this game was not because I scored a try in the corner. It's not actually because I got man of the match. It's actually because, as a game, it probably showcased everything when I was playing at my best that I could do as a player.
Yeah,
foundations of which were set piece, scrum, line out, but defence. Get a couple of turnovers, making some good tackles, running with the ball, everything. It just had everything for me in terms of enjoyment factor as well.
Yeah, yeah. And
played in the kind of conditions that, I was never the fastest, so brought everyone down to my speed, so great.
Yeah, take it. every bit of advantage that you got. But no, you're spot on. Again, looking back at it, if you wanted an advert for Nick Wood, it would have been that game, wouldn't it? You know, all of those things. Yeah, the try's nice. The man of the match was so well deserved for everything that you'd done. You know, throughout that, and it typified everything that you were about. So, and to come against Bath as well, in one of the big games, and as you said earlier, it wasn't a game where Gloucester ran away with it. It was nip and tuck all the way through, and certainly after the break, you know, Bath again seemed to go up a gear, and Gloucester were under the cosh, but the defensive effort was huge, wasn't it, right across the board?
It really was, you know, right to the end. I think the final play of the game, we, you know, Bath got a line out in our 22 and tried to maul it, and we end up turning it over.
Yeah,
absolutely obliterating either into touch or to a point where they couldn't play it, and that was the end of the game. Those are the games that I relish, the set piece battles, and backs in those conditions will probably look at that and go, that was a dreadful game. But yeah, that's the beauty of rugby itself, is that each game is going to have something different for everyone, based on conditions, based on opposition, based on style of play.
Yeah. And you know, there were, again, conditions, a couple of missed penalties on both sides, but gradually Bath claw themselves back, back to all square. And then I think it was Matt Banahan then got penalised, didn't he? Right at the death, and you've got one of the replacements on, Ryan Mills. He's 19 years old, and has to kick this kick, which again wasn't a straightforward one given the conditions and the pressure and everything else. And he slots it over to win the game. And again, that just typifies the whole game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Ryan's a great player, and you can see that obviously what he's doing now and what he's gone on to, and you know, instrumental for Worcester and now Wasps. You know, unfortunately, with a few injuries, but I mean, he was always a big talent. Mm. Yeah, physically at his age as well, just absolute beast. Yeah. But with all the skills to go with it.
Have you mentioned what a character and a talent Ryan was and still is, but that must have taken a hell of a lot of composure to slot that. Again, typifies his talent, doesn't it?
Yeah, particularly, you're right, that the mental fortitude at that age, it wasn't it's not like it was on the touchline or anything, but it wasn't an easy kick. Not in those conditions, you know, it's not, in terms of as a kicker, you're not 100% sure with your plant foot, and obviously the pressure. I think it was sat at 11 all the time in a game that we felt that we probably controlled more, you know, just about, had a greater share of the control than Bath did, but yet the score was sat at 11 all. He's 19. He's probably won his first handful of appearances, and he's certainly one of those guys that, you know, we look forward to him either being in the squad or coming on if he was on the bench.
And you know, he slots it, and as you say, even after that, you know, Bath still have a chance to get back level or even nick it, and that whole defensive effort from Gloucester sees them off at the end, and another famous victory, which is good. And you say, you know, four or so on the bounce against Bath, that must be a good feeling.
Yeah, it hasn't been done since, I suppose. So that period, that purple patch against Bath was certainly one to be cherished across that sort of, 2010, 11 to 13, maybe. Mm. And then it swung the other way.
Yeah, but that's sport for you, isn't it? Each sets of fixtures have their purple patches, and that was certainly a good one from Gloucester's perspective, and I'm sure all of the fans enjoyed that. As you said, you know injuries then played a huge part in the rest of Gloucester's season. You talked about the lack of strength in depth, I suppose, but it just fell away from there, didn't it? As you say, it's you know, five or six games on the bounce lose, and then what was a position where you were challenging for playoffs again suddenly becomes ninth. So that must have been quite galling, I guess, given the work that had already gone on.
Yeah, obviously that was upsetting. But there's certain things that you can't account for, and if, you know, fundamentally it becomes a financial consideration, doesn't it, in terms of why hadn't we got the strength and depth? Well, as a club, we didn't have the kind of money available to have the kind of squad that we'd had in sort of 07, 08. That's not to say that any particular decision was wrong. It's just to say that was the reality of how things were at that time. We hadn't really massively recruited for a year or two beforehand. And that was probably the knock-on effect. It wasn't the inevitable knock-on effect, but it was certainly much more likely once you started to get that number of injuries.
Yeah, and you know, but you don't get the injuries, and it's a different ball game, isn't it? You carry on pushing, pushing up there.
Some of that fortune, and some of it's also the fact that the same team was playing pretty much week in, week out for almost 18 months, which obviously has a cumulative effect.
Yeah, was I mean, in your many, many years at Gloucester, was which was the squad that was probably the best squad that you played with overall during your time there? Was it the 7-8 squad, as you've already alluded to?
Yeah, that was fantastic. As a young player, youngish player, I was 24 in 2007. Coming through that, you know, to play most games as first choice in that particular season, yeah, you know, that felt part of something special. A team that had absolutely wiped the floor of the league just came short against Leicester's full team. Mm-hmm. Probably a step too far for us at that stage. 08 was more frustrating. 08 was a really good squad. Had the experience of losing to Leicester in the final, and how we managed to throw away that semi-final at Kings Home, I'll never know. That for me, that was the year that went missing. 11, if we'd beaten Sarries at Vicarage Road, maybe. But I mean, that would have been a lot of good fortune. Mm. We had a good team. Wasn't as good as 08 in terms of overall depth, I wouldn't have said, but you know, a good experienced team. And fortunate as well that most were fit. So,
At that
stage of the season, to be able to put out your pretty much your first team, first choice team, was obviously a huge benefit to us.
Yeah. And chatting to Charlie last time about, you know, where Gloucester are now and the restart for the new coaching team has probably been a bit of a blessing, really, in as much that they've had five, six games to see what's at their disposal. Where do you think Gloucester are placed now ahead of the new season?
Well, I suppose, first and foremost, it's been rather upsetting to read about sort of financial troubles. And I know that Gloucester aren't alone in this, and it's obviously one of the consequences of not being able to have any fans. Well, A, having the shutdown, and then B, not being able to have any fans. Just be absolutely devastated if not just Gloucester, but other traditional clubs were to happen.
Well, I was going to say, just on that point, I mean, you know, Lance has been, you know, very vocal given his business background and so on, and quite rightly too, because, you know, they're asking clubs, you know, right across the Premiership to play games, pay their players, but without any income.
I feel obviously in terms of business it's upsetting that numerous clubs seem to be in this situation. It's also, I feel for the players, it's not like the game's become any easier. And, you know, professional rugby players, maybe a handful in each squad, have done very well out of sort of salary cap changes and a bit more money coming into the game. But, you know, by and large, the players are still doing far more than they're actually getting paid for in terms of, you know, what it does to their bodies and, you know, the sacrifice that it takes. That's not to say that any of them would change that in a heartbeat. I'm just saying that.
No.
Yeah, for them then to go and take initially a 25% pay cut, but also potentially who knows what's going to happen in the future. Yeah, it's not an easy situation to be in at all.
No, most definitely. But
I'd look at that and go, actually, I do feel fortunate that firstly I'm not doing that to my body anymore. It's definitely had enough. But secondly, you know, I never had that kind of worry. My worry is around, you know, was I going to be able to sign another contract and making sure I played my best to, you know, showcase what I could do, but also, you know, to look after my career in that sense. But I didn't have to contend with something like this.
No.
So I do feel fortunate that kind of my time has passed. I wouldn't want to have to go through this situation.
Yeah. And as you say, it's sometimes that, you know, it's individuals' livelihoods that are sometimes forgotten in all of the things that are going on, isn't it? You make a really good point. It's, you know, yes, for a handful of individuals there is a significant amount of money, perhaps but for Mr. Squad player who, you know, who's worrying whether they're going to get a contract next year now or whatever, it's huge, isn't it? Huge in terms of the mental toll and everything else that goes with it.
And there isn't that support network post rugby. It's not both. I think there are a lot of good noises, mate, and stuff is going in the right direction, but it's still far short of what it needs to be. And perhaps that's one of the trade-offs. If there isn't as much, or if it isn't going to be as much money in the game, one of the trade-offs has to be, well, how are we looking after you? How are we looking after you off the field?
Yeah.
You know, talking about situations where, you know, a director of rugby says to a player, I don't feel you're focused on rugby because you're thinking about your businesses. Well, actually, the conversation should have been, it's great that you've got something else going on outside. And so that's not me. I'm not using my own personal example. I'm just omitting names. But, you know, it's great that you have something else going on outside because, you know, knowing that your future is taken care of, or you're taking care of your future, will make you a better rugby player in the present.
Of course it will.
The support, you know, what do I miss? Let's think, personally, what do I miss? I miss, you know, having access to some of the world's best physios, you know, particularly in Bob Stewart. You know, the guy's, you know, British Lions physio, now England physio. He was fantastic. And, you know, it's not like I stopped playing and my body suddenly fixed itself. And I've worked very hard to make sure I can actually run around with my kids.
Yeah.
Access, I have had physio, but I've had to pay for it. You know, access to, you know, that kind of health insurance and stuff. I'm very fortunate that my job comes with health insurance. Yeah. How many of my pre-existing long-term injuries, not in terms of anything traumatic, but in terms would that cover it? I don't know. I haven't actually had to test that yet. But things like that, things to consider in terms of, you know, helping players detrain, helping players' bodies post-rugby, post-careers. I think that's something that needs to, there's still a trick that's being missed there. And maybe that's one of the trade-offs, that if players aren't going to be paid as much, that there has to be a better support network in place when they're finished.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think the rugby players that we talk to through HNHB, that's a common common comment, really, in terms of what you've just said. And again, talking to Charlie, you know, he's been doing his financial planning exams and has got one eye on the future and what comes next. But you know, clubs and businesses as well need to have that structure whereby there is that trade-off, as you say, to say, you know, I've talked to a few of the guys on the podcast and said, you know, things like as simple as work experience. You know, what can I do? What skills have I got? You know, these days people are coming, you know, almost from school straight into academy, that, you know, they don't get the luxury, if that's the right word, of your people like Deeks, who, you know, who went out and did a job in the amateur days, they don't know anything else.
I've discussed this with Alex Brown, with Steve Jones, who ran my testimonial year. I remember discussing this. I remember saying, well, you know, you've got this captive audience at rugby matches, particularly at home games. You have to make use of it. There has to be a system in place so you don't just get chucked in. When I first started, you get chucked into a box in the deep end. Don't know who you're supposed to talk to. Don't know who's taken the box out. Don't know what they do. You know, and some people, you know, I'm not always the most outgoing person, but at least felt that I was able to conduct a conversation or get something going. But you're not really capitalizing on a situation where most, if not all, people in that stadium are there to watch you or you and your team. Mm-hmm. You've got an in that, you've got the shared interest. Yeah. And with a little bit of background planning in terms of, right, this is so-and-so's box, or, you know, this is this particular sponsor, this is what they're doing, this is the person you want to speak to, he's brought his mother along whose 90th birthday is, that kind of thing, just to give you that personal touch. And you create those relationships, you create the network that you won't definitely need, but it's certainly going to help. You know, as we know how the world goes around, it's not what you know, it is who you know.
Yeah.
You might have a particularly unique skill set, but if you don't have a forum in which to express that, then you're probably going to come up short.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine a conversation that you alluded to, director rugby speaks to you and says, I think you're spending too much time on your businesses or what comes next or whatever. And player says to director rugby, well, actually what I'd like to do is I'd like to go into insurance. That's what I'd love to do. And director rugby says, oh, we can facilitate that because there's a huge insurance company that's our sponsor or whatever. How about I set you up and do that and make those wheels turn? I remember
just important is that kind of experience. You wouldn't have to be limited to one particular field of work, but that kind of experience, it's, you know, as we all know, Mark, that knowing what you're going to do in life is you know, only closely followed by knowing what you don't want to do. So to work out what you want to do and what you don't want to do at a time when you have another job, another life, another career, then that's the time to work it out, because it means then whatever job opportunities may arise, and some of it's down to good fortune, when you do retire, at least you have clarity of mind, clarity of thought that you know what you want to do. Yeah. And quite possibly you've acquired the necessary skills or qualifications or both to take that on.
Yeah.
And then, director rugby, there was a failure over the years. I think it's changing. My impression is that it's changing. And, everyone's loath to mention Saracens, I suppose. But one of the things they did get right was that they have a vested interest in their players' lives off the field, both during and post-career.
Yeah.
And they actively encourage it. They make it compulsory that you must do this kind of stuff, whether it's education, whether it's experience, whatever it is, you must be undertaking something. And the why is because it makes you, what's their gain out of it? It makes you a much better culture, which makes for better rugby players, a better team.
Yeah,
that's their gain. Okay. And, become sustainable in terms of, a community, a family that lasts beyond the finite lifespan of careers. Rugby careers.
That's the inference, is that there are green shoots and I think things are changing, but it needs to become part and parcel of every player's career as part of that discussion. It's not about you're already thinking about what you're going to do when you retire, therefore you're not going to be focused on it. It's about settling that aspect, so actually I can give 100% to being the best rugby player I can be, because I know what's coming next.
I know that one of the considerations when, and this will weigh on players' minds to varying different degrees depending on injury history, depending on where they are in their career, depending on responsibilities, family, kids, mortgages, etc. But one of the things that helps you get around that is knowing that if the worst were to happen, that you have a plan in place. Now, it doesn't matter, in some ways, it doesn't matter how far along that plan you actually are. The plan itself is what gives you the structure that you can fall back on. It also gives you a welcome distraction for something that's all consuming when you're involved in it. I never used to watch any rugby, barely any rugby. I might watch some Six Nations games when I was actually playing, because I would spend my life during the week analysing games, going through clips, analysing footage, preparing, reviewing. I didn't want to go home and watch more rugby. No. It had nothing to do with me not loving the game. I just needed to do something else.
Mm. Yeah. And has that changed now?
I've actually got, life is certainly not easier as in retirement. I'm busier. I've got three kids. My time in a boarding school is, no, it's not quite fair. My time, intern time, is flat out. But I wanted to get into a life, which I'm in, very fortunate to be in now, where I do get the trade-off of lengthy holidays. But obviously the flip side of the coin is that when it's in term time, it's full on. And it's enjoyable. I enjoy being engaged. I don't like doing nothing unless I've, specifically chosen to do nothing.
Mm. Yeah.
No, but there's variety. There's certainly much greater variety to my life in my second career.
Nick, it's been fascinating chatting, not only about the victory at the wreck, but also about some of the other things as life at Radley, and you know, I personally, I think it's fascinating this whole issue about support for players and careers and everything else. I think it's something that, you know, really needs to kick on now, and something good happen on the back of that.
None of what I said there is a complaint either. I was more than happy. No. I was aware of the challenge that it would, whatever happened with me in a second career would be down to me and me alone. It was my responsibility, and I was happy to embrace that challenge. And I'm sure many others will be. But that doesn't mean it's the right thing. That kind of support for all players doesn't exist should they want it.
Yeah.
Or should they need it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is an individual responsibility, Nick. Absolutely. You know, at the end of the day, you know, all of us have got to look after number one. You know, we have the ability to do that. But having a support structure for somebody that says, actually, I'd like to do this, but I don't know how. Can somebody point me in the right direction? And as I've said to other guys, you know, finding out that you don't like something is as important as finding out that you do.
Yeah. So, yeah. And as being willing to ask for help, there's also knowing who to ask.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's one of the things. I was fortunate when I was younger, we were encouraged to go into boxes and to talk to people and to be in the bar afterwards to have a pint. And to be honest, that's something I carried through the entire way. Whether or not I went into a box, I'd always, you know, win or lose, whatever. I could have had a dreadful game myself. The team could have played terribly, but I'd still want to be up there to show my face and talk to the people who just spent their hard-earned money coming to, you know, coming to watch us. And one of the benefits of that was that, yeah, when I retired, I did have a good network of people around me that I was able to ask for help as and when I needed it. Yeah. That's not the sole reason I did it. There was the community aspect, the benefit, the friendships made during the time I was actually playing.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. As Joey from Friends says, there's no such thing as a selfless good deed.
Well, on that note, Nick, we will wrap it up there. A pleasure to talk to you once again. Good luck with everything that you're doing at Radley, and good luck with the refereeing career. It's been a pleasure, Nick. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to the Rugby Buzz. Next week, I get to chat to former Wales and British Lions star James Hook about not one, but two of his favourite games, the 2007 and 2008 Six Nation clashes with England. As we all know, it's been a tough time for lots of people, and many charities that have relied on being able to put on fundraising events have seen their donations greatly reduce as these events have not been able to happen. At H&HB, we've been privileged to have supported many charities, schools and sports clubs with their fundraising over the last 5 years, raising over £100,000 for good causes in that time. We want to continue to support these organisations, even though live events aren't able to happen. So we're launching a new online auction service where anyone looking to raise money for their school, charity or sports club can work with us. You can auction items that you've been donated, whatever the value, or utilise our vast array of memorabilia and experiences, or a mix of the two. In conjunction with AMS auctions, the first of these is running right now, with all profit being split between three local charities, Maggie's Cancer Care, Heart Heroes, and Sunflowers Suicide Support. To have a look, just log on to www.amsauctions.co.uk and see what's available. Place your bid and help support these amazing charities. If you would like to support your organisation with something similar, then drop us a message on our website or via Twitter or Facebook, and we'd be happy to help. Thanks again for listening. See you next time. But for now, be safe.